The first cases on our docket for oral argument this morning are High Noon at Arlington Ranch Homeowners Association versus District Court, case 65456, consolidated with case 65993, D.R. Horton, Inc. versus District Court and First Light Homeowners Association. Each side will have 20 minutes. Each side will have rebuttal. I understand you've divided up your time, so are you ready to proceed?
We are, Your Honor. We just have one preliminary matter that we'd like to address with the court before we get started. Because we are going first as the appellant, 4 minutes rebuttal time. However, in speaking with the Respondent's Counsel, he would also like to reserve time at the end. And I tried to explain to him that I believe that if we get the chance to reserve rebuttal time, the appellant would matter.
Okay.
So we have that issue. If you could clarify for us as to how we could deal with it.
Sure. Wish to be heard, Counsel?
Bruno Wolfenson on behalf of D.R. Horton. Good morning, Justices. We are the respondent in the High Noon matter, but we are the appellant in the First Light matter. So we would like to reserve, and we did file a reply brief, so we would like to reserve 4 minutes of rebuttal time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you'll have 4 minutes of rebuttal in your direct appeal case, and you'll have 2 minutes of rebuttal in your 65993 case, and it'll be confined to that case.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Norberto Cisneros, and I'm attorney for the First Light Homeowners Association. In 2005, the First Light Homeowners Association, the membership, took a vote. And they took a vote to authorize the First Light Homeowners Association to bring construction defect claims against D.R. Horton in the name of the association. They were able to take that vote under 5.3 of their CC&Rs. Under the CC&R section 4.1, it states all agreements and determinations lawfully made by the association in accordance with the voting percentages established herein or in the bylaws shall be deemed to be binding on all owners, their successors, and assigns, which means that even successive owners are now bound to this vote that was taken by the membership that permits the associations to bring the claims against D.R. Horton. Since that day, D.R. Horton's done everything it can to usurp that power that the association has under Nevada statutes, the agreements, the CC&Rs between the homeowners and the homeowners association. They've been unpleased with the recent decisions, and now this is their last attempt, hopefully, to take away the association's right to represent its members. Your honors have sent us a message that you'd like to hear about NRS 40.640 subsection 5 and how that relates to this case. So I'm going to address that first. NRS 40.640 subsection 5, and actually 40.640 in general, is a way that contractor can escape liability in Chapter 40 construction defect cases. And basically, subsection 5 says they can escape liability if any constructional defect disclosed to an owner before the owner's purchase of the residence, if the disclosure was provided in language that is understandable and was written in underlined and boldface type with capital letters. I'm here to tell you that, at least as far as that provision is concerned, it is irrelevant to our cases. There's absolutely not a single shred of evidence that there's a single disclosure with that language. None has been provided to the court, and none is in the record. So therefore, that provision doesn't apply to this case. However, you have asked us to address it, so I will, in case you do find that you want to make a decision based upon that provision. As this very court has stated in its West Park Owners Association case, that provision deals with a disclosure provided solely by the contractor to the initial homeowners association. In the legislative history, which is noted in the amicus brief, it talks about how that provision is when a developer does something wrong in the construction of the project and they can't fix it. They have the right then to disclose it to the initial purchaser and say, look, this exists, we can't fix it. And if the purchaser then buys the property, it actually then they cannot sue on that basis because it's been disclosed to them and under this very provision the contractor has is immune from liability. However, I want to make sure that we understand this provision very well. If the court does believe, in fact, that it goes beyond that, and I know D.R. Horton's going to argue that, then what you're dealing with is it's a provision that then understands that there will be subsequent purchasers who still get the benefits of Chapter 40. If you're going to interpret that it's not just between the contractor and the initial homeowner, then what it really deals with is this language must be included for the contractor to get immunity from liability, must be included in a seller homeowner to a buyer homeowner. In that case, then the court should understand that clearly the rights of Chapter 40 go well beyond the initial purchaser, as D.R. Horton is attempting to argue in this case. In addition, it doesn't make any mention in 40.640 when it states the various grounds that a contractor may be immune from liability. It doesn't state anywhere that, well, however, if the disclosure is made subsequent to filing of Chapter 40, the contractor then also is not liable, is immune from liability. And that's very important because the legislature could have put that language in there if they truly intended that the moment a Chapter 40 is filed and there's a purchase and a sale of a property, and that, as D.R. Horton is arguing, makes the contractor immune from liability, then they could have put that language in there, but they didn't. What they said was it must be in bold, a disclosure in bold-faced capital letters, and absent that, the contractor doesn't have any liability.
Counsel, wasn't that an attempt, perhaps, by the legislature to keep some boundaries around when cases can be filed and how long they can go on? I mean, there was significant discussion, as I recall, around that area as to that we might want to put some timelines, if you will, on when and how these cases finally end.
Well, I would suggest, Your Honor, that the timelines involved in construction defect cases, as the courts have held, and particularly in ANSI, which I'll get to in a minute, talked about as long as it's brought within the statute of repose, it's a valid claim.
I use poor wording on my part. When I said times, I mean, to me, Chapter 40 tells us in its broadest sense that the homeowners should have an opportunity to have their home repaired, and the contractors and the subcontractors should have an opportunity to repair before they march into litigation. And that is the sense of Chapter 40. So how long, for what period of time, do we continue to allow people to join the party, so to speak?
Well, and that's a very good point, because that is the whole purpose. It's supposed to be a very broad, expansive remedy for homeowners and protection for the developer so that they can make repairs, they get inspection rights and repair rights. The whole sole purpose of that is so that they can get notice and that opportunity. In this case, the individual homeowners, as I mentioned from the get-go, aren't the claimants. The claimant, as which is permitted under 40.6.610, is the association. So the association gave notice of the defects. D.R. Horton is not going to disagree. They received notice of it. They then had the opportunity to inspect and repair and chose not to. The case then proceeded in normal course, was filed, and it is in the process 10 years later. Not because of anything of switching out of homeowners or anything of that nature, but because we've been dealing with writs and the various appeals that have occurred and the stalls and starts and stops in litigation. However, the whole purpose behind this is that there's no new defects added. Every defect that was in the Chapter 40 process exists today, still to this day, and they chose not to repair it. So every protection they had under Chapter 40, they got. There's nothing new. The switching out of homeowners has no relevance to this case because it's not being brought in the individual's names. The vote taken was so that the association, which is permitted under Chapter 40 and NRS 116.31021D, they have the right to bring these claims in their own names. This court has already validated that very premise, and that's what we're dealing with. So in relation to your question, the timelines were short. They were as per statute. The games played sense is, how do we ensure that the association, we can knock off, you know, homeowners? How can we get so that the association doesn't have standing to bring these claims? Those should be rejected by this court as they already are and have been in the Beezer Master System.
I have a foundational question, and it is, what harm would you suffer if we concluded that as a discretionary matter, we should not be interrupting the litigation in the trial court, rather we should deny mandamus, not on the merits, but because it doesn't actually affect the trial and this is reviewable on direct appeal?
I actually would agree with that approach, Your Honor, and I would believe that is the approach the court should take at a minimum. However, if they're going to address the issues, I'm here to address them. Having said that, in our case, First Light, that is exactly what the trial court said. The trial court said the association has the right to bring all the claims. They did so in their Chapter 40 notice. D.R. Horton had right to repair and to inspect and repair. They refused to do it, did not do it, and therefore the case is going forward on behalf of the claimant, which is the HOA. So from our perspective, in my case, now, Mr. Kelsey is going to get up here and have 6 minutes to talk, so may have a different perspective of that because he had a different ruling, which was that they knocked out probably over half of the homeowners. And understand D.R. Horton's perspective on this.
Shouldn't the court entertain these writs because you have conflicting rulings on the same subject?
That's a matter of
court.
I would leave that for the court's determination. It's
well, I mean, it's say. Easy for you to respond and say, yeah, let us go because you got a favorable ruling. I don't think that's the objective of your colleague's writ or proceeding. So in answer to Justice Pickering's question, as you know, one of the standards for undertaking writ review is whether there are conflicting decisions on matters of public importance within the district. Don't we have that present here? I mean, from a step back from the advocacy of your client,
my client,
focus now on jurisprudence. Isn't that a more appropriate response?
I believe that the trial court judge in Mr. Kelsey's case made an incorrect decision, and therefore I believe we do need some direction from this court on this issue.
But I have I phrased my question poorly. What I'm trying to understand is how these rulings on this issue of law affect the trial in these cases. Not the settlement, but the trial.
The way it would affect the trial is that the association would be in Mr. Kelsey's case, which it has more effect, it would prohibit the association bringing all the claims that they deserve to bring. They wouldn't be allowed to bring it on nearly 60% of their case, which in their case, they spent money investigating all the units, not just the ones that are in this case or that are left in his case. So for his case, it is tremendously important that the matter be heard and decided by this court and give some direction to how HOAs are to.
In responding to Justice Pickering's question, could you be more specific and just address your own case? We'll let Mr. Kelsey talk about his. But specifically, the claims asserted in the First Light litigation, if the ruling were to go otherwise, contrary to you, how would you be impacted if this court agreed with the ruling in Mr. Kelsey's case? What claims are asserted in First Light that would go away, and how would you be prejudiced by that?
The prejudice would be, and it would be tremendous prejudice, because the claimant as the HOA would then be denied to pursue literally 60-70% of the unit's defects. So what you'd have is you'd have a situation where the HOA, who is the true claimant, can't bring all the claims, and they would then be left with
inability. Be more specific, identifying the claim and a unit and the defect.
Let me give you a perfect example. We've tested probably over 1,000 windows in the community. Every single unit, or every single window tested had a defect. 60% of those windows would go with a defective condition if the trial court's decision in Mr. Kelsey's case is upheld. They would not be able to then effectuate repairs to nearly the entire or a vast majority of their entire community. They would be left with no recourse. In addition, if you believe D.L. Horton's rationale and arguments that are from California, even the homeowner is now will have to forego all their Chapter 40 rights or will be left with no recourse. Because under Chapter 40, which dictates how a construction defect case should proceed, a prior homeowner no longer is a claimant. They lose every right they have.
Right, but I think, and I don't mean to double-team you with the chief, but let's say you went to trial with 60% of the windows not an issue, but they're common. They've been determined to be common to the original group of claimants. So you go to trial on 40% of them because that's the ruling in one of these two cases. Say you win on those 40%. Then the 60% of those are appealed, and say this court reversed and said, yeah, all of them should have gone to trial. Where are you in terms of this? It would seem to me you're in a position to predict from the 40% victory what would be the outcome with respect to the remaining 60%. And to me, I'm wondering why we're doing this in the middle of a case.
Well, unfortunately, construction defect cases are very expensive. I'm going to give you the practical, practically what happens here is we'd have to do two different trials, which each one costs hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's not even after you send it back, whether it be a necessity for additional inspections, et cetera, because of all that, we could have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars spent because we have to do it twice. That would be the answer I have. I would like to not usurp all of Mr. Kelsey's time, so I appreciate it very much. I will be giving the rebuttal, so I'll be back to answer a few more questions.
Okay, Mr. Kelsey.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Scott Kelsey, and I represent the Highwood and Arlington Ranch HOA in this matter. I know you have some directed questions. I will do my best to try to answer those. I was prepared to discuss a couple of novel points here this morning that apply to our case and why, in our opinion, the District Court erred in their decision by relying upon the Ballet decision, which was the District Court's own decision involving an individual single-family home representative, joinder action, nothing to do with a HOA representative action pursuant to NRS 116-3102-1D standing, as well as some inconsistencies in the rulings prior to the subject ruling. However, with regards to how the direct impact of the case and the decision in our matter is, you know, we have 342 total units, lots of money spent with regards to the investigation of the defect claims that exist throughout the community and affecting the entire community. And then with regards to 112 of the owners of those units now only being the original owners when the complaint was filed, that's a substantial impact to the underlying investigation and the underlying defects that we get to pursue at the time of trial. In addition, with regards to the interior units, we go from 194 owners no longer owning these homes, so we're left with 62 to 64 of the interior unit claims that we spent a lot of money, the HOA spent a lot of money determining throughout the Chapter 40 process as well as through formal litigation. So it has a very significant impact if you don't make a decision here today in terms of what we actually get to present at the time of trial. And then, frankly, we're kind of shooting in the dark after the fact, post-trial, with regards to whether or not you're even going to consider these issues and reverse the ruling of the underlying district court, which, again, in our opinion, was an error.
Mr. Kelsey, there you've asserted a number of claims of relief. Is the analysis for successors different depending upon the claim asserted? And I'd like you to address that specifically as to each claim for relief, unless you think it's the same for all. But it seems like in the constructional defect cases, we tend to assert a series of claims for relief and then call them all constructional defect. But the elements differ, don't they? And if so, does the analysis of what claims survive with respect to successors differ from those that shouldn't?
I mean, in our case, for example, not only common area related claims were cut out for building envelope claims, but also then for interior unit claims. Yes, there could
be. Let's talk about the interior unit claims, because I don't know that the successor issue is as applicable. Let's talk about the interior unit claims. Is there a different analysis when you're talking about successors? Let's say for the moment the court agreed that a claim for the Chapter 40 claim associated with a breach of a defect, quality and habitability, is something that would survive to a successor. Is the analysis different for that particular claim as opposed to some other claims you've inserted in here, like breach of fiduciary duty or that sort of thing? Do you understand my question?
I do understand your question, generally, Your Honor. I think when you're looking at a representative action, I don't think that the claim changes its form. It's still the HOA that's pursuing the claims in its representative standing, pursuant to NRS 116. So I think the difference is, where is the defect located? Is it in a unit specifically, which my understanding from view of Black
Mountain. In a representative capacity, if you're asserting a breach of fiduciary duty claim, how does a successor maintain that claim? You're their representative. How does a successor maintain that claim as opposed to the original owner when you look at the elements of the claim itself?
I think with regards to the fact that the HOA has the representative standing to pursue two or more units owners' claims, I think that they inherit those claims as a part of the representative standing as the pursuant to NRS 116.
But can a successor buyer maintain a breach of fiduciary duty claim? Thinking about the elements of that claim.
It's a good question, Your Honor. We did reserve time for rebuttal, and I'd like some time to think about that and then perhaps readdress when I come back on rebuttal.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
You'll get your 4 minutes. And your time was cut short, Mr. Kelsey. I don't want to interrupt some point you wanted to make. So you take a few minutes and make whatever point you'd like to make, and then Mr. Cisneros will have his 4 minutes in rebuttal. Is there something else you wanted to communicate to the court that goes beyond our questions?
With regard, it was, like I said, Your Honor, we had a couple of novel points that dictated why we thought that the district court got it wrong in our case. The district court's reliance on the Ballet matter, which again was just an individual single-family home prosecuted action, a joinder action. We feel like the district court relied upon the wrong standard. It had nothing to do with NRS 116 representational standing by an HOA. In addition, NRC P 56, we found some error there with regards to the district court essentially bringing the Ballet matter into the case. Ballet was never referenced in the moving papers by D.R. Horton, and D.R. Horton even stipulates that prior to oral argument before the district court, the district court circulated the Ballet order. Nobody had really much time to consider it, and frankly, we believe that it didn't apply whatsoever, and so we believe that our client's due process rights in that regard were violated by the district court. In addition, like I said, another novel point was the inconsistencies with the NRS 116 representational standing. We have two orders that have been briefed and put in front of before the court where the district court specifically says that we have the HOA has representational standing pursuant to NRS 116, and then comes up with this artificial, in our mind, artificial split between, oh no, now you really only have representational standing for the homes and the units, the members of the association that were around when the original complaint was filed, as opposed to subsequent unit owners who came in and purchased units under the guise of they were walking into a construction defect suit and believed that they were going to wind up having those defects addressed, and then we were told and left with two-thirds of our case at the end of the day approximately stripped from us at the doorstep of trial. We're not talking about doing it in the middle of the case. We're talking about right before trial.
But I must again ask, if the court were to conclude that successors' claims, successors in interest, can have a constructional defect claim brought by the Homeowners Association on a breach of warranty or breach of contract or just a pure construction defect, how are you prejudiced when you lose a breach of fiduciary duty claim?
I don't see the prejudice there per se. I see the prejudice with regards to allowing defects that were originally noticed to D.R. Horton that they originally had their Chapter 40 right to repair and refused to do so, then them getting off with never having to be responsible for those defects by virtue of a subsequent unit owner purchasing a unit in a project that is currently in formal litigation.
Thanks, Mr. Kelsey.
Thank you.
Mr. Wolfenson.
Thank you. Honorable Justices, esteemed opponents, may it please the Court. This case is about standing. That's it, one issue. Subsequent purchasers in this case means people who took ownership or title to property after the prior owner had already made allegations of damages. The notion that the associations can represent these subsequent purchasers for claims they themselves don't have is unconstitutional. The notion that statutes like NRS 116 and even all of Chapter 40 can abrogate constitutional Article 3 standing requirements is unconstitutional and has been said so by the U.S. Supreme Court. In 2005 for First Light, in 2007 for High Noon, the then owners of all of the units, 100%, because the homeowners said it for them, said in their complaint, I own a unit, it is damaged, I have suffered a loss, I now own and have accrued a cause of action for that damage. This court, Nevada law, holds under Argyre in 1998 that damage to property belongs, and the redress for that damage belongs to the person who owns the property at the time of injury.
But let me interrupt you there. I mean, if you look at the statutory scheme here, they're asserting, as I understand it, common claims to the entire development. They're not asserting individually unique claims. And under the statutory scheme, if you look at NRS 116-3102-1D says, an association may litigate on behalf of itself or two or more units' owners on matters affecting the common interest community. And then you look at NRCP 17, and it says, a party authorized by statute may sue in that person's own name without joining the party for whose benefit the action is brought. So clearly, they're able to bring that in a representational capacity. And the damages, and I think this may be part of what Justice Hardesty was getting at with respect to what are the underlying claims. The damages for, say, repairing the outside walls of these units, if they were defective in some respect, would be common to the community. So they're bringing those claims. Why should it matter that the person inside that house or that unit has changed when the outside of the units still are defective or substandard?
I'd like to address that, Justice Pickering. If I own a house and I claim that it's damaged, and it used to be worth $100,000, and now you come along and you say, Mr. Wolfenson, your house is damaged. You said so in a complaint. I'm not going to give you $100,000. In your complaint, you say it's going to cost $25,000, $30,000 to fix that house. I'm only going to give you $70,000. I say, okay, I take the $70,000, and I'm on my way.
What about if I say I want you to assign your claims to me?
A completely different situation, okay. Right? And I completely agree with that. If I can convince you as a good negotiator to pay me $100,000 because I've got a great lawsuit and I've got crackerjack attorneys and I'm going to assign you my claims and them, then you'll give me full value and you've got an assignment and it's your claim and off we go. And we don't have any
objection. And if you assign it to me, I'm stuck with the decision you made when you voted to support this litigation, right?
Under the... If I assign it to you, correct.
Okay.
But if I don't assign it to you,
and I sell the unit, perhaps at a loss, I walk away with that claim. Justice Douglas wrote for the entire court in 2008 under Buzz Stew, same thing. When the prior owners, in that case it was Buzz Stew, sold what remained of its property, in that case to, I think it was Clark County, it did not also sell the right to compensation. And it could proceed against Nevada Power for the taking that they did, or the city of North Las Vegas, whoever declared the eminent domain in that case.
That's a very, very nice reading of that, but this case is slightly different. Mr. Cisnero got up originally and talked about the association and the bylaws and the assignment once all the members voted to proceed and assigning it to the association. So how does that then differ in this situation, whereas you're representing holding Buzz to if it's assigned?
Right.
He says it's been assigned, so how does that then play out?
So it hasn't been assigned. There is no operation in the bylaws that says the then current owner assigns its personal property rights, the cause of action, the chose of action, which we've codified under NRS 10.045, is a personal property. You can't take that away. Once my land is damaged, my cause of action...
So you're saying that their bylaws can't do that?
Well, what the bylaws speak to is the common area elements, and that was one area that I forgot to address with you. For the common elements, we have no dispute. Absolutely. They have the right, because they have the obligation under the CCNRs to keep those maintained. So even though I was a prior owner and I had an undivided interest in that common area, when I leave the association, I in essence leave those claims behind because I am not responsible for their maintenance. The HOA is. So I agree that that's a distinction. But my personal property, which in both of these cases is defined as literally the fence of the yard and all the property in there and the unit, when that has been damaged, I'm the one affected, and I walk away with that as a prior owner. Now, I want to make this important point. The issue here is who owns the cause of action for the allegations in the complaint? Well, obviously, the owner of the unit at the time of the complaint. There is no magic transfer mechanism for those causes of action. They've declared, I'm damaged, I own that cause of action. The Homeowners Association would have you believe it doesn't matter who owns the property at any point in time. Well, it does. They would have you believe when an association brings a representative action pursuant to 116 on behalf of its members for Chapter 40 type remedies, somehow the UCIOA gives them unconditional standing. We don't have to worry about standing. We don't have to worry about the U.S. Constitution. The subsequent purchaser somehow buys the lawsuit, or what was their word? Inherits the claim. They don't inherit the claims. They don't buy the lawsuit. That's illegal. They buy the property. They take title to the property. They don't take title to the cause of action. They claim the current owner is the claimant regardless of changes in ownership during the pendency of the action. They don't even say the current owner steps into the shoes of the prior owner. They just somehow miraculously have their own claims, like for breach of fiduciary duty claims. Broadmoor is a case decided in Colorado that talked exactly about that, that said, and that was a district court case, but it said, subsequent owner, if you took ownership after a fiduciary relationship with the builder who was then in control of the HOA, you can't have a breach of ownership, a breach of fiduciary duty claim, because you were in a fiduciary duty. Now, if that's UCIOA state, if the UCIO somehow magically transfers claims from a prior owner to a subsequent owner, then Broadmoor would have said, hey, subsequent owner, you do have breach of fiduciary claims because the claims of the prior person magically transferred over to you or were, as they said, inherited.
Mr. Wilson, are you indicating that that new owner has to have a specific assignment from the previous owner of that claim, or are you artfully saying it's impossible to assign?
No. I'm not saying it's impossible to assign. They can absolutely have an assignment from the prior owner. And that's what they should do if they want to continue with those claims. As the example with Justice Pickering and myself, me selling the damaged house to her. But that prior owner can also take their claims with them and continue to prosecute them on their own.
So if that is the case, then if it's been assigned to the association, it hasn't been rescinded, why should it die?
If it is assigned to the association, and we do have that in High Noon, we have some assignments in High Noon, if it has validly been assigned to the association, then the association would own the claims. But that's different than a non-assignment. Now, I do caution the court here, in terms of the assignments were obtained in the year 2010. Some of those assignments, like a handful, were made by original owners to the association. In that case, the assignment would validly transfer a cause of action that is then existing to the association. But the other 190 assignments that were made by people who took ownership after the complaint had already been filed. They don't have standing to bring the claim, right? I can't stand here and if I watch an accident, say, hey, are you going to file suit, Mr. Third Party? You're not? Well, let me file a suit on your behalf because I think I can get money off of that. That's what these subsequent owners are doing. And you can't do that under Article 3 standing. The U.S. Supreme Court in Hunt has specifically said if an association wants to represent its members, it has to meet three prongs. Prong number one, right? The member must otherwise have standing to bring that claim. And the U.S. Supreme Court in United Food and Commercial Workers in 2006, or 1996, one of the two, it's in our papers, said, hey, that first prong, along with the second prong, is a constitutional requirement. You cannot abrogate it, not by statute, not by Congress. It is a must. It is a case in controversy, Article 3 issue. I'm sorry.
Mr. Wolfson, that's very nice, but I think coming back to what we have before us, the legislature has attempted, sometimes they got it right, sometimes they got it wrong, to create a situation, as Justice Seda indicated, the opportunity to repair where it's appropriate. And for claims to be put forth, a response, and when we have a situation where the developers don't repair, don't inspect, and just attempt to walk away, I guess I'm questioning, why should they be gifted?
They're not gifted. They stand to face liability from the person who has standing for that. The person
because as
who
I hear your argument, you're attempting to limit the language put forth in 116. And I guess I'm looking for not references to workers' rights or anything else, but specific references in this particular case and the specific language in this case as to either the association bylaws or what was done or not done. So I'd like, if you can confine it to that, give me some very specific and particular arguments for or against.
For or against?
The position you're now taking. I understand what you're giving me, these various standing arguments, but a lot of times, Busto was a perfect example. Busto is different from what we have here because of what's been placed in Chapter 40 and what's been placed in Chapter 116. So how is that affecting? And I know we have this situation where we're talking about, in one case, common interest items versus individual interest items. And as Justice Hardesty talked about, let's talk about the individual dwellings where they're appropriate, because that may be a different analysis from the common interest areas as to your assignment arguments you're making or lack thereof.
Sure. First of all, there is no difference between the exterior of the units or the interior of the units. I mean, I know in our day-to-day warfare down in the trenches back in the trial courts, some of the judges have drawn that distinction. But that is an illegal distinction, meaning it doesn't have a basis in legality. There is no difference in the ownership, CC&Rs, between the interior of the units and the exterior walls. It's all owned the same way by the same individual. And that's going to be for another day, I'm sure.
So you would say that the seven of us, we may own our individual office here in the court. Do we own the whole building on the outside?
Well, it depends how the CC&Rs are written for your ownership. Because some CC&Rs give you airspace, some give you the ownership of the walls, some give you ownership outside of the walls.
But that's where they're talking about the common interest community.
Yes. If you want to say that the person who buys a unit, whose CC&Rs say you actually own the real property inside your yard, and you actually own the building, and you actually own the interior airspace, and you actually own the walls and the roof. If you want to say to that person, you know, even though you make the mortgage payments, even though you took out the loan, you don't really own that. The HOA owns that. When you get damaged for that, and you suffer a loss by selling your unit at a loss for a reduced price, you don't get compensation for that. The HOA gets that. Then I lose, and their position is correct, that the HOA owns the units and owns all the claims for the damage to the property. But that is not the state of the law. That is not what real property ownership is about. And there's nothing in the CC&Rs that give that authority to the HOA. Make no mistake, that's exactly what the association is saying. They're saying, I don't represent people. I represent units. It doesn't matter who owns it. It doesn't matter if the jury's deliberating and somebody sells their unit. The money's coming to me, the association, and I'll take care of the units.
I want to interrupt you there and ask pretty much the same questions I was asking at the outset, which is, how are you harmed by going to trial rather than having us come down from on high and issue some sort of writ here?
Sure. The trial in First Light would be about 100 units rather than 400 units, because 304 people have now left with their claims. The trial in High Noon would be about 100 units versus almost 300, because similarly, many people have now left. So the people that remain, most of them don't have standing to bring this suit. So the association would be bringing suit on just those who had a claim and who have standing, either by they were the original claimant or they got an assignment.
Ultimately, it's going to make a difference to the total judgment. But what I'm getting at is a little different, which is procedurally, what is your unique, irremediable harm that justifies us interceding with an extraordinary writ?
Truly, the remedial harm is if you were down there in the trial courts on a day-to-day basis, as Justice Hardesty said, there is a lot of confusion about what to do. And if you were to tell these people after they spent a lot of money presenting evidence on 300 units that they didn't need to present, that they were not entitled to any of that relief, yes, that would be a burden in this case. But if this court could issue an order saying, look, subsequent purchasers do not have standing in their own right, you need to get assignments, then these folks can start practicing a little bit differently and make sure that if they're going to continue with those claims, they take the appropriate steps so that the HOA can represent.
And was it litigated at all in any of these cases that we're here on today that some claims might remain with the HOA despite a subsequent sale, but others might be personal to the original owner, such as breach of fiduciary duty? I mean, that seems like a personal claim to me.
Okay. They're all personal claims once you suffer an injury to property. See,
But bear with me. Was there any distinction made in the district court as to the nature of the claims on this legal issue that you're presenting here?
Not necessarily by the judges. I can tell you we entered into a stipulation with First Light where they voluntarily dismissed certain claims that they realized, gee, you really had to be there looking at the developer in order to make that claim, like a breach of contract, like a fiduciary duty.
Okay, so those claims are out in that case?
So in that case, those claims are out.
Right? Okay.
You know, you talk about an entire statutory scheme, and I would ask you to look at NRS 113.150. That's the treble damage of cost of repair statute, where if I sell to you without disclosing a defect and you find a defect, you can come and sue me, the seller, for three times the cost of repair. If you have an automatic transfer of rights from a prior owner to a subsequent owner, why would you need that, right? Because the transfer of right would allow you to sue the builder for that. There is no automatic transfer of right. Any effort to interpret 116 or Chapter 40 as providing that sort of transfer and obviating Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution standing is unconstitutional. It doesn't allow that.
I think we understand your position. You'll have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Cisneros. And we'll keep everybody within their time where time's running out. I think we understand the issues.
I will do my very best, Your Honors. Real quickly, to address your point, Justice Hardesty, in our case, we've actually understood the distinction between the claims we're bringing. We've narrowed them to negligence and breach of implied warranties. That is it, because those are common amongst the entire community. Let me begin by saying every case that has been cited by D.R. Horton in this matter comes out of California or comes out of the federal jurisdiction and has nothing to do with the NRS 116 or the Chapter 40 scheme that deals with construction defect cases in this jurisdiction. Chapter 40 talks about this issue of bringing claims, and it's the only way a construction defect can be brought. So when they talk about these prior owners, well, they're going to continue with their claims, this is the fallacy in that argument. They cannot. A claimant is specifically defined under NRS 40.610. A claimant can only be either an owner of a residence, which if they've sold, they no longer own, and they no longer hold any claims, or number two, an HOA. Other jurisdictions that this court needs to look at are other UCIOA jurisdictions which have dealt with this issue, and they have, and there's a litany of decisions, including from this court. But in particular, we have one that is out of Colorado, which when standing was tested there, and they've adopted the UCIOA just like this jurisdiction has, they found that, they said, following the national trend acknowledging the representative capacity of the association, and substantial difficulty on the standing issue in Colorado, enabling the association to represent more effectively its owners in such matters as construction defects, avoiding the necessity of assignment of claims, powers of attorney, or class actions in many circumstances, and thereby simplifying and making more practical the prompt action in the association's and owners' common interests.
Counsel, notwithstanding the association statutory scheme that you referred to, and of course the uniform standard, does Colorado have a similar statute to Chapter 40?
Absolutely. And that's what's so important, because Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, it's an act that exists and the states can adopt. The Nevada has adopted. Colorado has adopted. I believe there's 13 states that have adopted it. And when they adopt it, they put it into the statutory scheme. That's exactly what exists in Colorado, exactly what exists in Nevada, but does not exist in California. The litany of cases cited by...
I think my question was, does Colorado have a Chapter 40?
Chapter 40... they do not have, I'm not certain if they have a Chapter 40 per se, but they have the NRS 116 statutory.
Well, of course they do. They're yes. A uniform state, so okay.
Correct. And I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. But they allowed the construction defect case to go forward based upon 116 and the standing provided under 116.
And that is exactly what exists in this case. California does not. In fact, the statute that D.L. Horton cites saying, oh, see, Nevada has a similar one, it's very similar to 116.31021D, actually is not. What they forgot to cite when they cite the statute is the limitations upon the types of actions that an HOA can bring. And the limit limits it only to common area claims and claims where the association has responsibility for maintenance. It doesn't go beyond that, whereas in Nevada it does. It says that we can bring matters affecting common interest community for two or more homeowners. So
you can argue this case without application of Chapter 40?
You can, but it makes it stronger because Chapter 40, in addition to 116, gives standing to the association by defining it as a claimant, which it is in this case, and by permitting it to give notice to D.R. Horton. In fact, the notice statute says you can give notice of the construction defect claims by the HOA.
Are the remedies for the representative claims for relief limited to the Chapter 40 remedies specified in Chapter 40?
They are, Your Honor. We've tried to go beyond it. We've always been rejected. It comes down to the fact that we're limited to those.
So your answer to my question is insincere or incorrect in that you could not proceed simply under 116. You need to impose our Chapter 40 requirements.
They come into play. They play hand in hand, Your Honor. So you get standing through 116 and Chapter 40 because this is a construction defect claim. There may be tax claims. There may be other claims that the association could bring outside of the construction defect realm, where 116 comes into play and Chapter 40 doesn't. But we're dealing with construction defect. And to deal with construction defect, we've developed the Chapter 40 process, which enhances the HOA's ability to bring this as a claimant and give notice. And then they're off and running. And
one last thing, Your Honor. I think we understand your position, and you've run out of time.
Okay. Mr. Wolfenstein? Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. You have exactly 2 minutes, Mr. Wolfenstein. And by the way, this may sound silly, but please confine your roaming to the podium, not because I'm trying to insult or make fun of anybody, but the camera's on you, and we want to make sure that the webcast keeps track of the lawyer.
I was trying to avoid that. Justice Douglas, United Food Workers, yes, the underlying claimants in the association were workers and workers' rights, but it goes directly to the issue of associational standing. It says, and I quote, as Hunt's most direct address to Article 3 standing, the first prong can only be seen as itself an Article 3 necessity for associational representative suit.
Yeah, I
that's
appreciate
a page 555.
Standing, but I'm concerned about standing pursuant to Chapter 40 and Chapter 116.
But the point is you can't abrogate constitutional law standing. Now,
if that was directly on point, I probably would just wholeheartedly face accept it. But I'm curious as to 40 and 116 standing.
Okay, let's talk about cases that are directly on point. Colorado, UCIO case. They came down with Buffalo Park development case. The court there wrestled with, can I give a homeowners association the right to object to a water permit that's being applied by a different developer? And they felt compelled to go through the associational standing in Hunt and all three prongs. In our own jurisdiction, our federal sister court in Waterfall case has addressed the Hunt requirements in finding that perhaps the third prong, by reading United Food, can be changed by statute, can be modified by local legislatures or the Congress. But that one is, do we require individual participation in the suit? The first two prongs can't be modified. So every time we talk about, well, doesn't 116 and Chapter 40 envision, if it envisions taking away standing, it's unconstitutional. And it doesn't envision that.
All right, thank you, Mr. Wolfenstein. I'm sorry to cut both of you off in this glorious discussion, but I do sincerely, I'm making light of this, and I shouldn't, but I do sincerely appreciate the excellent briefs and advocacy in your cases, and we appreciate this input. Mr. Kelsey, thank you. Mr. Cisnero and Mr. Wolfenson will take the matter under submission.